effectively what they're sort of doing is breaking the antenna into infinitesimally small segments each and calculating each current and the polarity and the interactions with each other segment and coming to some conclusion. It is based on horrifying mathematics, and the concept was proven physically through practical experimentation, where the old days they would put an antenna in an anechoic chamber with a signal strength meter and position it in three-dimensional space, record intensities, and map nodes and nulls and what have you, and correlated them with the mathematical model. I hope that helps.
So every time you see a modeling of an antenna and a drawing of the lobe of the antenna, that's all based off of a military or government calculation?
It sort of depends, again, on marketing. If you're building a center-fed dipole, you don't necessarily need to simulate a center-fed dipole because it's about 5,000 images of what the lobes look like, and you could just grab one off of the Internet. So it's a more generic, more non-specific type of presentation. But theoretically, if you wanted to, you can enter all the information applicable to your center-fed dipole and have it produce a simulated radiation pattern. I've done that many times. I had a bunch of articles in the LIMARC log, e-log, where I took different types of simulated antennas and generated their resonances, what band they were resonant on, and what the radiation pattern looked for different bands. In a multiband antenna, the lobes and the nulls don't stay the same when you shift from one band to another. Even a center-fed dipole, depending upon where its location is relative to the ground, will greatly affect the type of radiation pattern. The donut that everyone talks about is only happens in free space. If you put it closer to the ground, all kinds of wonky things happen.
So you say all these programs and all these diagrams, once again, let me ask the same question, are not really, they're all copying some experiments and the results of some experiments done in really high-tech laboratories. Is that what you're saying, Roy?
Not exactly. What I'm trying to put across is that mathematicians and physicists have come up with very complicated algorithms that mimic real-life patterns that were manually, recognized and recorded. So it's not like no one ever went to an anechoic chamber and tested to see whether that antenna simulation for a given real antenna is legitimate or absurd. But the results that you get if they're generated from an antenna simulation software is based upon the algorithms for that version of the simulation. Like I said, they've gone through, as far as I'm aware, five versions. The fourth version you can get for free. The fifth version, you gotta fill out a document, some kind of federal document, and pay them a fee before they give you any C5. So all the stuff we see tends to be based upon simulation software because it's incredibly cheaper to do that than actual mapping in an anechoic chamber.
WB2EAV.
Yes, Ed.
I spent a lot of time in anechoic chambers and antenna ranges, but let me just say one thing. A simulation or an antenna range, both designed to give you an ideal environment, antenna in a real-world environment. Let's take a ham radio antenna next to a house it's a house nearby, the trees nearby, that's all going to change the pattern. And if it's near, say, aluminum rain gutters, all bets on the specific pattern are off. But the simulations are meant to match data taken on antenna test ranges, yes.
Yeah, but yeah, as you kind of implied, it's a lot easier to screw up a simulation than it is to screw up an anechoic chamber. It's an unusual environment, I agree, but there are so many variables to enter into an antenna simulation that if you get one or two or three or four of them wrong, it can give you really ridiculous results. I mean, if there is settings these days for the quality of the ground, and if you put in the wrong quality of the ground, you'll get strange things. There's so many different ways to kind of screw up a seemingly beautiful simulated antenna.
Now, what kind of simulated antenna are you talking about? Usually, you know, they don't bother with, you know, with verticals and dipoles. They're usually doing more sophisticated stuff.
Well, it depends. Amateurs are now able to get for free rather good antenna simulation software. Like I mentioned before, I did a string of articles in the e-log where I took apart a whole bunch of different antennas starting with a center-fed dipole and showed people the calculated radiation pattern and how incredibly it's affected by just the consequence of the distance it is from Earth ground. So, you know, hams do that all the time. There's YouTube filled with it. There's articles on the Internet filled with it. I mean, I'm sure engineers do much more sophisticated stuff with more sophisticated antennas. But amateurs kind of start with dipoles and work their way up, usually.
Why do you need to simulate a dipole? The simulated coverage pattern is in every ARRL manual ever published. The antenna patterning work I've done is with fairly sophisticated multi-element antennas, phased arrays, etc. Now you're talking about really complicated stuff. I'm not hearing anything complicated. Why do you want to do such a simulation of something that's in all the textbooks?
Well, the last time I looked at the textbooks, they just kind of boil it down to the most simplest thing. If you look up a center-fed dipole, you will see that lovely donut. And if you have a center-fed dipole at a half wavelength above Earth ground, that's what you get. But if you move that center-fed dipole any other place, you get a different radiation pattern. So that's usually not people don't bother to calculate things like that in textbooks because it takes up too much space. And they want to move on to the next topic. So I'm willing to bet you that if you look up any place in a textbook, for the most part, a center-fed dipole, you're going to see a donut, and only a donut. And the problem is that if you put that damn center-fed dipole close to the ground, it ain't no longer a donut.
Yeah, and so you're saying you'll adjust the height of your 40-meter dipole so you're going to work that DX on the low end of 20?
Not necessarily, but as a visual demonstration to people who say, the best that I could do is put my 40-foot dipole 3 feet off the ground. I just, there's nothing higher that I could post it on, so I'm just settling for 3 feet. And I just think that if people can visualize what they're getting when they do that, they might look a little harder for a longer pole.
I know I work for Asia. With a 40-meter dipole that was about 6 inches higher than I am above the ground, so it shouldn't catch me in the neck and choke me. So I'm not so sure you need that level of sophistication. Now, if you're working on something for deep space vehicle tracking, now we're talking something entirely different, where things have to be absolutely perfect.
Yeah, I understand, and things in amateur radio don't necessarily have to be absolutely perfect, but it's nice when it's better than it was. And, you know, I mean, when you talk about antennas, what they're capable of under some circumstances, you know, I'll repeat myself that I've mentioned more than a few times that there was a guy who later went on to manufacture antennas who just wanted to see what the lowest common denominator could possibly be. He took a 100-watt light bulb, he put it on a, I think, a 4-foot lamp fence post, and he got a worked all state certificate out of it. So, you know, even the worst antenna is better than no antenna, and, you know, some antennas that on paper don't look that good operate rather well. All well and good, but I again think that people and people don't really have a good appreciation for how height affects things like horizontally oriented antennas. And so I think antenna simulation software is a nice way of creating 3D imagery that people will absorb than someone reciting, you know, the fact that they become near vertical incident sky waves if you place them relatively close to the Earth, where they reflect back on you and then absorb a lot into the ground. That's all I'm saying.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I've said many times on this end, if you are doing a serious antenna, if you are doing something where you have a main lobe a few degrees wide, if you are dumping something like deep space tracking, yes, you must be perfect. But I don't understand this obsession about all this complex mathematics for working on 20 meters.
I don't think you need to understand the complex mathematics. I think if we have tools that are available to give people a little bit better insight into how things are operating, I think that's generally a good thing. Does it necessitate that you go crazy and build the perfect antenna? I don't think so. But I think that a lot of people don't, you know, they hear the words, but they don't really see what they mean. And if you can present it to them in a visual version, they get a better understanding. And I'm always for a better understanding of things than a worse understanding of things.
Yeah, better is better, yes.
Okay, we agree.
PhD?
Yes, Jim.
Sounded to me like this antenna modeling is all like weather reports. Take your umbrella and your sunscreen.
Well, I'm not telling people to depend upon it. I'm just telling people that at least on my part, I find it a good educational tool to visualize aspects. And I've also cautioned on this TechNet only 10 minutes ago that it's a case of garbage in, garbage out. If you don't know how to use the software, it's very easy to get terribly wrong information, and there's no easy way to check on it. No one that I know here on the TechNet has their own anechoic chamber. They probably don't even have a signal strength meter. So, it's not the end all. I don't expect or would think anyone would depend specifically on antenna simulation software. I think it's an interesting tool for educational purposes. That's what I use it as.
No argument. I couldn't.
Okie doke. Rich, any more on this?
Well, the only thing I'd like to hear more about is, what did you say about a version 4 and a version 5?
Okay. The program that really takes everything apart and segments it into infinitesimal lengths of wire and calculates those infinitesimal currents and then interacts them across the antenna and such is a very sophisticated calculating engine. The present one that's available is version 5. Version 5 requires that you fill out some kind of form and basically register and pay them a fee, and then they'll give you the engine that plugs into the front end. There are about 5 or 6 different programs that are the front end for this engine. So that's it. Presently, the previous version, which is not as accurate and doesn't have as finessing controls, version 4, you can get version 4 for free. So they give it away. But for the latest, greatest version 5, unless they've changed it recently, you have to go through a couple of hoops. You know, it's not impossible, but it's expensive. I think it's something like $125 for a license to use any C5.
When you say pay them, who are they again? FCC?
No, it's not the FCC. I forget. It's some government agency. I don't remember if it's some engineering branch of the government or which branch. But it's some federal agency that produces these versions of NEC.
Okay. Yeah, basically that's what I was looking for, you know, how are those derived, and I guess it's from this piece of software that you can now buy or use for free. So, yeah, that answers my question, Roy. Thanks. WTBC.
Okay, very good. Like I said, it's probably looking into the underlying method that it uses would drive most of us a little batty. Because real antenna physics, if you ever pick up a graduate level antenna theory book, you'll instantly get a nosebleed. Among other things, it requires the use of something called matrix mathematics. So, you know, there's a big difference between the ARRL's handbook of antennas or there's a German handbook of antennas meant for amateurs. They leave the mathematics behind and just tell you the regular stuff in words. So, yeah, none of us really want to know about the matrix math involved. I remember Dick, K2RIW, may rest in peace, used to say that the mathematics was his least favorite aspect about antennas. Anyway, thank you as always for your participation, Rich. Next on my list is Jim. What's your question for tonight?
Okay, I suppose I'll go with this. I've been dealing with some balance things recently, and I've got the equipment I need. I would have put it up today or yesterday, but I was attending a motorcycle class. I basically did my road test for driving a motorcycle at 59 years old. Dumb. But here we are. So, I buy these balance, and they come in a box, and they're 10 times heavier than they need to be and whatnot. I see some balance that are basically, for lack of a better word, naked. The toroid, the wire is wrapped, and there's no covering. It's just out in the open air, and the wires are done such that the connections are soldered, and they're impervious to weather. Is there any reason why that's a bad idea? Seems to me like the box situation, it always leaks, creates a situation that is going to fail, whereas if you just let the thing dry out naturally, it'd be better. Any thoughts on this from any of you folks?
Well, I will open it up to the general audience. The thing is that it depends upon how weatherproof the enclosure is. And there are people out there who will drill a hole into the enclosure in some lower portion of how it's going to be mounted so that water can drip out, but it's less likely to drip in. Usually, in the past, my attitude is enclosures are better than no enclosures, because then you're really playing games with how well wires are all heat shrunk properly and sealed up, capillary action can draw water, water can produce corrosion, corrosion produces failure. But I'm more than happy to hear from other people in the audience that have had many, many more decades of working with balance, some enclosed, others not enclosed, for their opinions.
VDH with a comment.
Yes, John.
Yeah, well, I think it's always better to enclose it. And I think it should be have drip holes on the bottom, in the same way that when you cork around the window, you cork around the top and sides, but generally you leave the bottom open so that any moisture that does get in can drip out. So in the same way, you want to enclose it, but you want to have some form of drainage on the bottom. Go ahead.
Okay, yeah, I agree with you entirely. It's best to buy the enclosures completely sealed because the manufacturer has no idea how you're planning to orient the box. And all it takes is a simple drill to have some breathing holes at the base. So I agree with you entirely.
Thought and response?
Finally, Jim, this is your question.
So the biggest failure point that I can find is the connector. And all the feeble attempts I see at trying to seal connectors seem feeble or much worse. I've been trying to eliminate the connector entirely. Have the coax go up over a symbol at the dipole center point. Have the end of the coax facing down. Solder the connections to the balun to the coax cable. Heat shrink tube that, but have it facing. So the gravity is always, water doesn't obey cork and seals. It obeys gravity. There's nothing you can do to stop it. To slow it down, but you can't stop it. But if you let gravity work in your favor, coax is hanging down rather than up. This double wall heat shrink tubing with the adhesive inside connected into the balun wires wrapped around the toroid up to the dipole legs and have no connector whatsoever. The connector is always a failure point in my very small bit of experience. Am I wrong?
A comment.
Well, the connector is certainly one possible failure point, but all the solders that you make are theoretical failure points. And you have to, in addition to considering gravity, which I agree with you is very important, you have to keep in mind capillary action. Because capillary action can defeat gravity, usually. So if you have two objects that aren't perfectly well sealed to some, that there's a little opening, capillary action can draw that fluid up into the solder joint. So, you know, it gets complicated.
Capillary action, big factor. I agree, good point. There was somebody else trying to get
your comment.
Yes, sure, please, John.
The openings should be on the bottom. Any drainage holes you have, of course, will be on the bottom. That's what I mean, in that you, no matter how tightly you try to seal the top, moisture or condensation will work its way in. But so long as the drainage is, I should say, consistent with gravity, so it can rip out the bottom. That's what I'm saying. I don't think you want to have all of your length of coax permanently connected into the actually soldered into the balun connections. I think you're going to want a connector. I agree the connector should be mounted with a good metal connection so that it can take any mechanical stresses and strain, but I think you do want a connector there. Go ahead.
Okay, that's a good point. There's a certain degree of strain relief in a box with connectors. Connectors, though, can be a point of failure. There is endless literature of how to weatherproof UHF connectors, which are not inherently waterproof. All manner of things I remember reading. My particular take was to use silicone self-sealing. Well, you could use dielectric grease to block water, and I wrap it in silicone tape, and then I wrap the silicone tape in standard electrical tape, and some belt suspenders and staple gun people will then spray acrylic clear paint over it to do another seal. You can go as many levels of redundancy as you want, but yeah, it's a failure point, but I think it's also beneficial mechanically to the design and opens you up to better options. Eventually you might want to swap out the balun or swap out the coax, and having to unsolder it and defect it, it sounds like it could be a bit of a pain in the backside.
K2SDP.
Yeah, Chris.
So this is something I'm pretty good at. I've had many boats, fishing boats over the years. So putting VHF antennas up and making connections that are salt water and ocean waterproof is pretty difficult. It's like I forgot the brand name, but there's a marine spray. It's basically like spray painting your terminals with a plastic. It's like a rubbery plastic. So what I can tell you I did on my antenna, which I've done on all my boats, up on my roof, and I also live on the water, so I have the same problem here. I coat everything with that, so it's completely, basically waterproof unless it wears off. And then I cover that with atomic tape. And the atomic tape is that silicone tape that you comes in different colors. And the reason I do that is that the UV, the sun rays, will burn through whatever you spray on it. And I think that atomic tape protects it for a very long time. So with the combination of the two, you're waterproof basically for as long as you're going to need it.
That's how far I'm
going. Did you hear Ed?
I heard Ed kicking in.
We're calling to Val Spar, V-A-L-S-P-A-R, Marine Barn.
Chris, do you hear Ed?
Sorry, I did not. I'm mobile, so got a bad receive right now.
Okay, he's asking if it's a particular marine varnish that he used.
No, it's not a varnish. It's actually a protective. Boy, I wish I could remember the brand. I'll be home in a little while. I do have it at home, so I'll look it up when I get back in. I'll key up when I get in. But it's made for battery terminals. You spray it on, it turns red, and then it hardens like a rubber, and it's coated forever. But if you're going to be in the sunlight, I advise protecting that with something additional like the silicone tape, the atomic tape.
Okay, I don't know about the atomic tape. I use generic silicone tape. I find silicone tape, though, is very sensitive to friction. That's why I cover it with electrical tape that's UV-proof, too, and it can take friction a lot better than I've seen silicone do.
The trick with the silicone tape, it's atomic tape, is the same thing. Atomic tape is the original name of it. The trick with that is you have to stretch it almost 50% when you're putting it on. So most people make the mistake of wrapping around like electrical tape. You have to pull it 50%, so stretch it as you're wrapping around something, and that stretching somehow makes it stick and hold much better. K2SDB?
Yeah, I'm aware of that. I remember trying to explain it to someone who was going to do some roof antenna job for me, and he just kind of looked at me like I was a little off in the head. But, yeah, I'm familiar with it. But even so, I'm sure you've attempted to unwind the silicone tape after you've applied it, and it's not that really difficult, even if you do the proper stretching and such. So, I don't know. I mean, just from the literature and my own experiences, I've never kind of depended purely on the silicone tape. That's kind of my first-line waterproofing because it has a nice feel, although I've read articles that there's a little capillary action that sometimes happens. Then I cover it up with some 3M electrical tape, and, you know, that stuff isn't going to leave unless you really want it to leave. Whereas, again, it's not that difficult to unroll silicone tape even if you stretch it.
Yeah, I guess. It probably also makes a difference on the brand or the quality of that tape, because I've had some that don't work very well at all that I've gotten on Amazon. I have ones that were made for the marine environment that you can't get them off. I mean, it's basically, it comes one piece, it all fuses together, and that's what it's supposed to be doing. And that's how you stretch it. Something about the chemical reaction when you stretch it, it almost heats up and it fuses, and you can't get it off.
WF2N.
That's all.
Yeah, well, I've used a duct seal product. You know, they use it for HVAC applications, that type of thing. You can get like a pound of it for like $5 in Home Depot or something. But I put that on countless years ago, decades ago. And then one time I had to redo my wires, and I took that apart to see it. And it was perfect inside, you know. I covered up our PL259 joints, you know. And it, stuff is impervious to weather, the sun, everything. Back to you, Mark.
Yeah, they also, I think they call it coaxial. It sounds like it could very well be the same exact product. It's very useful for that purpose. It's a pain in the backside to get rid of, though. So it's not one of those things like the silicone tape where, you know, even with the electrical tape, I'll take a box cutter, I'll cut through the electrical tape, and it's gone. I carefully unwrap the silicone tape, and that's gone. And I have a relatively new, shiny connector behind it. If you use the coax seal, it looks like you've dipped it in tar for the rest of its existence.
I'm not sure about the coax seal. This is regular duct seal, you know, that they use, that, like I said, on they use it on ductwork. You know, Tanaka's used to use it all the time. It works very well, but, yeah, it's really for a forever job. You know, you want this to be there, you know, 20 years from now. Back to you, Ron.
It may not sound like the same. It may not be the same stuff, but it sounds real close to it. Yes, Chip?
So, let's take this back a step. Imagine this box that this imaginary balloon is in, and it's got an SO239 connector on the bottom, and you connect a coax cable with a PL259 connector on it, and you use one of these various versions of atomic snot to try to seal it. Creates a situation that you can't undo it, so it's no longer a connector, just a lump of atomic snot. And I can't think that it's not better just to run coax through a hole in the box, a little smear of atomic snot on the bottom of the, you know, around that which doesn't really have to be sealed anyway, because gravity precludes anything coming up through it, any substance. Although Roy's wicking action is definitely worth considering, but in that case, it's solved. And you can redo that connection far more easily than a snotted up coax connection that's been covered in this atomic snot type stuff. Maybe I'm crazy, but that's my idea.
Well, the thing is that you seem to be taking the worst-case scenario. Like I mentioned, I'm not really familiar with the product that Paul uses, but I am familiar with coaxial, and it's kind of like atomic snot, which is a good brand name if you ever go into the business. But that's just one option that I never liked because it's kind of one way. As I mentioned before, It takes me about 30 seconds to undo all the weather sealing that I do. If you have it, dielectric tape goes inside the connector to kind of leave no empty space for water to run through it. Then you wrap it in the silicone tape and you pull it properly. And then you wrap that in good quality 3M electrical tape. It probably takes about maybe 60 seconds to do and 30 seconds to undo. So that's my solution.
That's the better number. 30 seconds to undo is workable. Okay. I'll take that under advisement. Thank you for the feedback.
You're welcome, Jim. Anyone else with anything to say on the subject, feel free.
K2STP.
Yes, Chris?
I just thought of the name. I think it's Johnson. Johnson's battery terminal I very highly recommend, and it does come off very easily, but it will protect out in the elements, including salt water, and not let any water in.
Okay, very good. I mean, marine products are always a good idea when you're looking to weatherproof stuff, because, at home, you know, sometimes you can get away with things, sometimes you can't, but, you know, in sea, I would assume you can't get away with much.
And it sounds useful for some other applications I have in mind. Thank you for the info.
Yeah, it's very nice being able to be in a group of people with different other interests where the hobby kind of poked its head and gave people new ideas of using standard products for other industries entirely. So thanks, Chris. Thanks, Jim, for participating tonight. Another great question. Next on our list for tonight is Wesley. What do you got for us tonight, Wesley?
Into exceeding science fiction. So, nothing special. We have ground effect lift versus hovercraft and hydrofoil. That's quite few professionals in airplanes and flight in the global family operators. I believe they would need to have something to say about it. Did you read my email?
I saw significant amount. I wasn't able to watch everything and read everything. There's only so many hours in the day. But I kind of perused it.
Okay. So, one of the last Wednesday, Iranian released the photographs of the drone, suicide drone, using ground effect. And there was a history on it. Echo. A Echoplan that was the first one in 1970s, Soviets, then they sold six of smaller version of it to Iran in 2009. And sometimes people have a problem to find out why is it working. This thing is able to make, to lift five times its weight on the flat surface or over the water. I believe Dr. Roy would be able to say a little bit more about it. Dr. Roy.
Well, you know, my expertise does not extend to aeronautical design, but there are such things as ground effects for planes. The problem is there are benefits to operating. There are problems. You have to operate relatively close to the ground, obviously. And if you don't have a reasonably flat ground, that can kind of wreck your machine. So a ground effect can be a useful aspect of the design in planes and hydrofoils and all kinds of fun stuff. But it's a lot probably safer in the water, where for the most part things don't poke out of it. But I would assume it's a kind of a double-edged sword when you have air drones that are equipped for ground effect, because most of the, you know, as far as I've seen, the battlegrounds tend not to be perfectly flat. So that could go either way, as far as I know.
It was quite puzzling when I read that that the small Iranian pilotless aircraft can fly up to 4 hours and has a range of 600 miles. It can fly as high as 3,000 feet and as low as 20 inches above the Earth's surface. It has a camera that can be used at night and in damped condition. That was especially developed for Persian style water service. I don't know what they mean by that, but it was the model number is RQ-170 Sentiel drone. Now, the reason that I'm talking about it is previously when Russia started to be short of missiles, they purchased from Iran drones, suicidal drones. They were regular, like a small airplane, but very small one. And they caused a crisis in Ukraine because they were bombing a civilian structure and of high voltage cables and transformers and stations and whatsoever. Let me jump. And now we have a situation where those guys probably gonna use this kind of drones. Imagine that you have a 20 inches over the flat surface of water. I don't believe because it must be a little bit higher, but speeding to the, in 200 miles per hour, a suicidal bomb. Actually, it's not a bomb, it's a drone. Right, and that is quite interesting. So the story behind this was that in the 70s, Russian developed a humongous airplane that was able to cruise over the water, and then around 2096, they started to make a small version of it, which was Orion 20, a Kronoplan from Russia. And about 20 of them were sold to Iran. And then in 2016, Iran presented the first version of that suicidal drone. And now, last Wednesday, we had that little bit change, or I don't see much change, the version of it that probably is going to be shipped to Russia and they're going to attack. But Ukraine doesn't have any ships of military grade, so probably Ukrainian could use the same drones against the Russian who have at least 25 vessels right now, military vessels on the Black Sea. But what is the difference between hydrofoil and ground effect and hovercraft? If you could say a few words, Dr. Roy.
Well, I was hoping you would say a couple of words because, again, this is not exactly my expertise. I just want to mention as an aside because I forgot to mention it earlier. The whole reason for the ground effect is apparently this lessens the drag coefficient of the wing and thus produces a more efficient flying vehicle. You get a longer duration, longer distances. That's why they risk the problems by contact close to the ground where it could, you know, destroy the machine. If it one bump is too many and it's gone. So it's more a drag-reducing benefit that the ground effect has on these devices.
Yeah, from the article that I have in front of me, it says that U.S. military has relied increasingly on drones for combat missions, and President Obama signed an executive order that was in 2009 to prevent non-combat from being killed in the drone strikes. And that shows more than 64 civilians have been killed in 473 drone strikes authorized by Obama in 2009. That was in response to the early version of the RQ-170 Sentinel that was just in the process of being developed. So now we see another threat. It looks like a small airplane with two air inflated I don't have a wording for it. Right, I'm not prepared for it too. But anyhow, coming back to what is the difference. So the ground effect is aerodynamic drag that aircraft wings generate when they are close to the fixed surface. And this gives about the five times of the load on that drone or that airplane comparing to its own weight. It's quite powerful. Now the hydrofoil is a lifting surface or foil that operates in the water. So the similar appearance and the purpose of aerofoils used in airplanes, planes, both use hydrofoil technology, also simply they call it hydrofoil, right? And hydrofoil craft gain speed, the hydrofoils lift, then the boat hull out of the water, decreasing drag and allowing greater speed. I believe we were talking about similar concept in Switzerland and Holland. They were trying to promote this kind of technology. Do you remember that, Dr. Roy?
WB2EAV.
Yes, sir.
Well, you made a comment. This is kind of out of your area. It's kind of in my area. So if you have any questions, let me know.
Please, Ed, feel free. Again, my expertise in aeronomics is rather meager. I just know the details.
So I clarify ground effect, foil, and hovercraft.
That is correct, if you
yes.
don't mind to say a few words about it.
Yes, please do it.
Ground effect, the only place I've ever really seen it seriously discussed, where airplanes are landing. As a plane is coming down to land, at the last 10, 20 feet, it compresses under the wings, between the wings and the ground. And it descends more slowly than it had been a few seconds ago. Pilots have to be aware of this, prepared to trim up the plane or flaps or something to counter it or land in accordance with it. They just have to be aware of it and know what to do about it. That as you get really, really close to the ground, mint rate, changing nothing, will slow down and you might chew up a lot of runway without using it. The problem, you do something about it. It's no problem, just be aware of it. Hydrofoil. A hydrofoil, basically a regular boat capable of high speed with a regular hull, but there are like some wings under the hull, separated, from it like a C shape. In other words, there's some struts going down that are very fine for going through the water, like a wing. What happens is, it's going to be a high-powered boat that can go very fast, and it reaches enough speed. The wing lifts the boat up out of the water. The hull, at the ideal speed, is completely out of the water, and the wing is taking all of the weight, which is much, much less frictional resistance than the hull would be at that speed. So you can achieve a higher speed than you would without this feature. A hovercraft, the boat that has huge fans blowing air down, so it basically lifts off of the water to then reduce the friction. Now, most of the hovercraft that I've seen, the idea is to have the fans covered by some kind of a shroud that goes right down to the waterline. At the optimum, to minimize air leakage out the sides, to have a very small gap to the water. But of course, taking waves and the like into account, there's all kinds of variations on that. Does that help, Roy?
Yes, indeed. Thank you very much, Ed. I read someplace that in addition to the pressure situation, aeronomically, apparently the ground effect produces a less drag coefficient on the wings during that period of time.
Let me be very blunt. Let us not get into the science of it until we're sure we need it. If you just want to know what ground effect is, it, you have to put a little effort into dropping as those last few feet if you're worried about putting the plane down at the right point. But yeah, you know, I believe it's that a pressure between the wings and the ground that you don't have, there's no ground there. If it's some other mechanism, you may very well be right. I never did a detailed mathematical analysis, and I have no intention of starting now.
Okay, unfortunately, my all-star kind of dropped your audio signal just as you started that last comment. So if it would be possible for you to give me a short version at least, I'd appreciate it.
The whole thing, or can you give me an idea of where it disappeared to at least you?
It disappeared when you hit the push to talk, unfortunately, and I had to disconnect, reconnect about four times before I could get the audio back. All-Star is amazing in some ways and infuriating in others.
That's what I said, short version is, there are different ways of looking at the physics of it, but the bottom line is, the only place I've seen it, that when you're trying to land the plane, but as you get closer to the ground, if you do nothing, the plane will descend at a slower rate once you get close to the ground, then you have to take that into account in planning where you're putting the plane down.
Oh, okay. I appreciated that. I think that they're utilizing another aspect of ground effect for high-efficiency drone operation, or at least that's what the literature on the subject would suggest.
If you're talking about some variation on the sea-skimming cruise missiles, you're very right, but I do not know anything specifically about that aspect.
Okay, but I do appreciate your insight into all this. Again, I haven't read too many books on aeronomics, aerodynamics, or any of that. So I appreciate it.
It helps.
And you have. Wesley, is that it on ground effect? Do you have any more?
No, actually, that's about it. The second subject that I sent you is probably you didn't have a chance to view it because it's a video. The video was about, hold on, let me go to that, undetectable bug. So it was like a 1 hour for the transmitter to build yourself whole instruction in that video, and 1 hour for the receiver to build it up. The guy is, you have Veritasium and a few other guys that you like to watch. This one is also interesting. It's a quite honest person. He said 2 years ago we had a project. And in that project, there was a building, and the building was required to be wired with microphones in every room. So it was total surveillance with the motion detectors, cameras, and microphones. And the task was, if the person is walking, then the closest microphone should pick up and send whatever they're talking about. Let's say there was a corridor or there was a room. So the sound was kind of equal. And at that time, that was 20 years ago, they contacted a professional. And the professional, if you know about the audio, the microphones and the very thick cables, and you can connect them. You have as many inputs to the amplifier, and an amplifier is amplifying the signals. Eventually, you can record the signal. So, at that time, the cost was estimated about $40,000. And the guy find out that he can make it for pennies. So, at that time, 20 years ago, they reached the cost per microphone about $120. And on that video, the guy is showing how to do it. You don't even have to have a PCB specially made for it. He just cut the PCB with the knife and show the pattern, show the schematic, show the discrete element that has to be there. And actually, there are few of them only. And the interesting part for it was that the connection was done with Cat 5 cable, which is the cable that was used for the network connection. Right now we have a Cat 6, a Cat 7. So a Cat 5 has 8 wires, 4 pairs. So out of one cable you could have 4 microphones. But he went even more into that. He said, in every house you have a plenty of wires not used, some of them from the old alarms, some of them from the telephone, even some wires, coaxial cables from the old cable TV, and you could use it too. So, what struck me is that at the end of that video, the gentleman says, there are professionals and military professionals who have all of that fancy stuff to find out if there is a bug in the room or is a bug in the building. And they go by the assumption that everything must create some sort of near field or far field radiation. So we just scan through the receiver to find presence of it. And he showed that the equipment that is available on the market, at least whatever he was able to get access to it, and he said, this, what we've made 20 years ago, is undetectable bug. It's something that nobody is able to find out unless they decide to demolish the whole building. Back to you.
I hope you can understand me, because it was your audio through all that I was kind of different. So first, let me ask the thing on the website right now.
Are you breaking up to Troy? Repeat, please.
Okay, well, let me just make a call for a few times. Something wonky is going on with it.
It's like either somebody's putting the carrier on you, or you need to reset your transmitter because your signal is not readable. The strength of the signal is okay, but it's not readable. Back to you.
Okay, how's that? Is that any better? That doesn't look good from way before. I don't know what's happened to that ball star that I back to half. I will try to go start and read it after. I'll be on time for half of the day.
Roy, you are consistently cutting in and out about 4 or 5 times a second. It's your audio before, like, 8 per second, chop for an 8 per second, back for an 8 per second.
Okay, let's see if that comes all the time now. I don't know what to say, guys. I don't know. The old archive isn't really working right now. It's broken up in here any bit. So probably it will be the next year. My apologies to the West. Maybe we can move on to the second report.
scrambled. It's like you put your hand into in front of your mouth and you move it so many times like that and try to talk with the talk to the people. That's how you're sounding now.